Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington, D.C.
By Monday, we would want to see the interdiction being removed. We feel that this is an attack of our constitution. This is an attack of the fight against corruption. So it is in
Malawi civil society groups issue an ultimatum to the government to reverse the decision to suspend the executive director of the Anti-Corruption Bureau.
The Public Order Act in its current form has no defects whatsoever. The defects are with we, the politicians, that are abusing it to suppress our political opponents.
A member of parliament says successive Zambian governments abuse the Public Order Act.
The real issue here that we are having in Africa and climate change is actually the impact of the climate change from elsewhere. Africa contributes very little. And therefore, what we are talking about is how do we actually adapt the lifestyles of people so that they can actually reduce the impact of the climate change.
And the chief executive officer of AMREF Health Africa warned African countries to head the effort that focuses on climate action in health policies. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Civil society groups in Malawi have unanimously issued an ultimatum to the government to reverse the decision to suspend Martha Chizuma, the executive director of the Anti-Corruption Bureau. If it fails to do so, the groups warn they plan to organize a series of protests against the government. The civil society groups say they will hold a press conference on Tuesday to press home their demands for their administration in Lilongwe to remove the prohibition. This after the government announced it had suspended the anti-graft agency head over a leaked audio that went viral last year. The move prevents Chizuma from carrying out her duties as head of the Anti-Corruption Bureau and also stops her from traveling abroad. Gift Trappins is the appointed spokesperson for the civil society groups. He tells me that the prohibition undermines the fight against corruption.
The civil society organizations have mobilized and have agreed that the government should remove the interdiction immediately. By Monday, we would want to see the interdiction being removed. We feel that this is an attack of our constitution. This is an attack of the fight against corruption. So it is important for the government to listen to the public outcry. And that is why we have issued, we are issuing this ultimatum. And also we are saying that if they cannot rescind the interdiction as civil society organizations, we are going to mobilize. Actually, we are going to have a press briefing next week, Tuesday, to tell Malawians the depth of demonstrations if the government is not rescinding this interdiction.
Some people are saying the anti-corruption chief, anti-corruption bureau chief, is not above the law, and that the leaked audio is very damaging for this interdiction. Your response to that?
There are several schools of thought, but what we are saying is that the president himself said that he has forgiven the SCB director. That's a safe space, meaning that the government has still the trust of the SCB director. And he alluded to that if any individuals would want to pursue any matter related to the liquid audio, they should do that in their personal capacity. So in this case, what we are seeing is that the government is the one that is taking this case forward, maybe instead of the individuals. And that is why a lot of Malawians are angry, because the president is not living by his word.
Well, critics are saying that the government wanted to do this all along. It's just a matter of time before taking action on this. Others are saying that everybody should be treated equally, in spite of the fact that the president said he had forgiven her. So action needs to be taken to ensure that it serves as a deterrent. Your response to that?
Yeah, I think if you see all this cycle that is going on, I think it's from the onset. It's like a history, because it started with even the appointment of the ACB director, where people didn't want the ACB director, you know, to be confirmed as the ACB director in the case press. So whatever is going, the politics that is going around, I think this issue is a pushback on the fight against corruption. If the government is really committed, I think they will have lived by the by their words in terms of what they are doing now. But if you can analyze it critically, you find that the government is saying something else and it does something differently. That is why even the Commission of Inquiry, you know, did not tackle the issues that they were supposed to be tackled during the Commission of Inquiry report investigations. And questioning the whole process, you know, I think there is a merit, because the government, you know, has been behaving differently in terms of making sure that they're able to support the office of the ACB director, including the ACB as an institution. I think we haven't seen that commitment, and it has been through and through. And that is why people are questioning the motive behind the interdiction of the ACB director. I think they are justified as Malawians.
Well, Gabe, some people are saying that the interdiction does not necessarily mean undermining the fight against corruption, and that the procedure or the process by which the mandate is being pursued by the Anti-Corruption Bureau is irrespective of who leads the organization, and that the organization will still pursue people who have committed financial malfeasance. How do you respond to that?
I think these are just, you know, legal arguments. But what we are saying, the basic underlying issues, is that I think they have to free the ACB as an institution to make sure that it is able to operate freely. But what we are seeing is that the office of the director is being diverted, you know, to deal with the other related matters instead of going to the core of the issues of corruption in terms of, you know, addressing them.
Gift Trappens is the appointed spokesperson for the Malawi civil society groups. He spoke with me from the capital, Lilongwe. A member of the Zambian parliament says successive governments have misinterpreted and abused the Public Order Act. Munir Zulu says the law is clear and only requires citizens to notify the police about organizing a public gathering. It does not, he added, require permission from the police. He contends that successive governments have misinterpreted the law and have pressured the police to prevent critics from organizing public rallies. Zulu's remarks come as Zambians call for the Public Order Act to be amended. For more on the law and its requirements, I reach parliamentarian Munir Zulu.
The Public Order Act in its current form has no defects whatsoever. The defects are with we, the politicians, that are abusing it to suppress our political opponents. Remember that in the Zambian history, no one has been convicted by the competent courts of law for having organized unlawful public gathering. It has never happened. The police will disrupt public gatherings, they will arrest the organizers and release them on bond 2 days later. And we have seen those cases die a natural death. So the question to ask is, what is it that they want to bring in the Public Order Act? There is nothing to change. All we need is political will to respect the provisions of the Act.
Are you saying that previous governments or governments in general in Zambia have been abusing this public order law or act?
Yes, the previous successful governments, together with the current regime, are equally abusing the Public Order Act. There is a difference between notifying and seeking authority for one to organize a public gathering. So it is abuse of the act by those in power to oppress their political rivals. So I don't understand what it is that they're going to change, because I've had taken time to peruse through the act, and I've had taken time to read the Christine Mulundik and six others case on public order. I can tell you to say there is nothing that needed to be changed. What we needed to do maybe was to get to a stage as a country where we make the office of the Inspector General of Police be ratified by Parliament, so that the IG cannot be fired for having authorized or ignored certain public gatherings.
But Muniri, isn't it the reason why a lot of Zambians have been calling for the amendment of the Public Order Act, so at least it could be plain, it could be self-explanatory, and then the authorities will not take advantage of it to clamp down on the freedom of assembly as enshrined in the Constitution?
We must bear in mind what the constitutional provisions are telling us. The Constitution, in its preamble, says this Constitution is the supreme law of the land, meaning that any other law that contradicts or contravenes the Constitution of the Republic of Zambia shall be declared null and void to that extent. Yet the Constitution of Zambia gives me my right to assembly, freedom of expression, freedom of association. So I don't understand why our focus should be on the act when the Constitution is very clear and explicit. Freedom of assembly, freedom of association, freedom of belonging to the religious group of your choice. So the act for me is not the supreme law of the land. So I don't understand why we're making a lot of noise over this Public Order Act.
What do you think is the best way forward in order to conscientize or sensitize or educate Zambians and the authorities about this current Public Order Act that is being sought for, or that people are asking to be amended?
As a country, I think we need to have a lot of public forums to sensitize the citizens that, look, we cannot amend an act when the Constitution, which is the supreme law of the land, is very explicit on freedom of association, freedom of assembly. So let the church be involved in preaching this message to the people. But if there is anything that we need to do right, is to deal with the substantive legislation, which is the Constitution.
Muniru Zulu is a Zambian parliamentarian. He spoke with me from the capital, Lusaka. In Kenya, the chief executive officer of AMREF Health Africa says it is important for the continent to head the effort that focuses on climate action in health policies. Dr. Kithinji Gitahi also says Africa must leverage local solutions to the problem. His comments come as experts say African countries are bearing the brunt of the effect of climate change despite having not significant contribution to it. For more about his call to action, I reached Dr. Githinji Gitahi via Skype.
The real issue here that we are having in Africa on climate change is actually the impact of the climate change from elsewhere. Africa contributes very little. And therefore, what we are talking about is how do we actually adapt the lifestyles of people so that they can actually reduce the impact of the climate change. The local solutions will come from the communities themselves. Some of these solutions include local foods, growing local foods that are more climate resilient, looking at adapting certain irrigation mechanisms that are going to help people improve food security, but also looking to adapt to changing disease patterns. We are seeing that malaria is rising. We have to understand, therefore, that the health system needs to be adaptive to the changing disease environment. So the communities have to generate the solutions themselves, but the governments have to support them. And this is what the communities are doing. Even when there is flooding, communities now know where the flooding is going to become more persistent, and they have to find the local solutions themselves.
Why do you think it's important for Africa to lead efforts that center climate action in health policies?
You see, Peter, the thing we're having is that whereas governments have listened a lot to this climate change conversation and understood it to mean purely reducing carbon emissions, Africa's contribution to carbon emissions is important but minimal. In fact, half of that is actually South Africa and Egypt. So many countries are contributing insignificantly to the carbon emission. But the distribution of the consequence of climate change is equal across the world. It's therefore impacting Africa significantly more than its own contribution. In other words, there is no discount for climate change consequences, whether you contributed to the climate change or not. You don't receive a discount. This means that African governments need to lead on adaptation. They need to lead on, kind of reducing the impact of these consequences. This means that the health system, which is going to be one of the most affected, is going to be affected because, of course, food is scarce, and malnutrition and undernutrition is going to increase. And this, of course, comes with diseases like increase of diarrhea and other malnutrition-related diseases. We are seeing patterns of Lassa fever, chikungunya, some of these viruses. We are seeing malaria now going to areas it wasn't before. We are seeing hospitals being washed away by flooding. So the health system needs to think very carefully, and governments need to think about how do we make the health system adaptable to the consequences of climate change.
You talked about African leaders leading that effort. Are you pleased with the efforts African leaders have made so far? Because a lot of promises have been made, but yet to be realized. Are you pleased with where things are at the moment?
No, I'm not pleased. And the reason I'm not pleased is because many of the African countries have actually just followed the Western narrative. We must reduce carbon emissions. And therefore, all of them are talking about whereas it's good, plant more trees, we are going to make sure that we use more renewable energy. All those things are important. But none of them, very few of them, maybe countable, Senegal, Mauritius, Malawi, who are talking about adding adaptation to what we call the nationally determined contributions. The nationally determined contributions are every country's commitment on climate change. I think that African governments must add adaptation of their communities, the health systems, the food systems, as their core mandate, as actually the immediate priority, before focusing 99% of the actions on just reducing carbon emissions, because reducing 50% of the carbon emissions from a country in Africa, contributing significantly to reducing the climate change or the global warming agenda, because the countries contributing are US, China, they are those that are advanced. African governments, whereas they should mitigate against future contribution of carbon emissions, they must focus more, 80% of their time, on mitigating the impact of global warming on their communities. This is why I think they haven't done anything, because when you look at the nationally determined contribution, very few of them, if any, have any discussions on adaptation.
Dr. Githinji Gitahi is the Global Chief Executive Officer of AMREF Health Africa. He spoke with me from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. Popular Ghanaian reggae musician Rocky Dawuni is expressing excitement following his third Grammy Award nomination. He was nominated for the Best Global Music Performance at the 65th Grammy Award. His first nomination was in 2015. His nomination was secured by buzz surrounding Dawuni's song Never Bow Down, a collaboration with a Jamaican artist. The 65th Grammy Award show is scheduled for Sunday at the Crypto.com Arena in Los Angeles, California. Here is the concluding part of my conversation with nominee Rocky Dawuni.
I sense activism. How do you combine your music with activism? Because obviously it's important to you.
I've always recognized that as an artist, you know, you have an ability to have a deeper sense of you know, how things go on in society, and also an ability to communicate. And you also have that gift and platform too. If you leverage it very well, you can really use it to impact social transformation. You can use it to also contribute to your community. You know, so for me, my music has always been about uplifting people, you know, bringing light into the world, bringing God, bringing inspiration, you know, creating bridges to people, you know, elevating what is good within all of us. So when you are an artist that sings about that, a lot of times you cannot only talk about it, you know, in order for your words to ring true, it has to also be a way of life. And so my activism is actually, it's directly related to my music, because the activism gives me that validation, spiritual validation within myself, and also being on the ground to seeing things that are going on and engaging people. And through all of that, to being able to have a deeper sense of what is happening, to be able to distill that message into my music. You know,
for the next 10, 15, 20, perhaps 25 years time, where do you see the musician and activist Rocky Dawuni?
I know that as a musician too, and somebody who is also very interested in the continent and also issues to do with not only the African continent, but also the diaspora, being a personality that through my music and activism, trying to connect, you know, the two, and eventually be a musical instrument for the real unity and unification of Africa, politically, socially, economically, and also with the diaspora. You know, that's a kind of a vision of mine, to utilize the path that I've been given to manifest that. So I believe that right now there are just so many different things going on when it comes to the geopolitics of the world. You know, even when we look at Black people in America, there's crossroads right now, you know. So, you know, you only have to see the George Floyds and all of the stuff that is going on to see that people are dealing with a certain existential questions as to where they truly belong. And I feel that that vision has a possibility of manifesting in these times. And so if you ask me 20 years what I think that I will be central to this evolving vision, and hopefully within that frame of time there will be a real unification of the continent, and music will be the vehicle that will drive that connection.
All right, Rocky, before we go, what is your message to your fans? And for people who will be listening to you or watching you for the first time, what will be your message to them after this third Grammy nomination?
Well, my message to them is that, you know, you have to always, you know, believe in your inner voice, you know, believe in what you are. You know, everybody's uniquely, you know, their own person and their identity. And you don't have to compromise that just because there is you're being forced or directed to become something that is not true to you. And so if you have a certain talent, if you have a certain vision, if you have a certain gift, you know, put energy into that gift. you know, nurture that gift, and so that you can utilize that gift to contribute meaningfully to your advancement and also advancement of your community, and then also the advancement of all humanity. You know, so that is my message for everybody. And keep smiling, and you know, keep being true to yourself.
Rocky Dawuni is a popular Ghanaian reggae musician. He spoke with me via Skype. To mark World Cancer Day Saturday, the World Health Organization is calling for action to tackle breast cancer, one of the most common and deadliest cancers in the world. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
Every year, more than 2.3 million women are diagnosed with breast cancer. The World Health Organization says all things are not equal. Surviving this deadly disease, it says, depends upon where these women live and their ability to receive needed treatment. It says the chances of survival for women who live in poor countries is about 50% less than for women in rich countries. For those who receive the best care, it says the survival rate is greater than 90%. Bente Mikkelsen is director of the Non-Communicable Diseases Department at WHO. She says a limited number of high-income countries have succeeded in reducing breast cancer mortality by 40% since 1990. She says taking collective action to close this rich-poor inequity gap could save 2.5 million lives in the next two decades.
Time is unfortunately not on our side. Breast cancer will be a larger public health threat for tomorrow, and the gap in care will continue to grow. By the year 2040, more than 3 million cases and 1 million deaths are predicted to occur each year worldwide. Approximately 75% of these deaths will occur in low and middle income countries.
WHO is launching a global breast cancer initiative to tackle the looming threat. The initiative contains a series of best practices for addressing this significant public health issue. The main recommendations include early diagnosis, noting that improved breast cancer outcomes begin with early detection. It says the earlier benign conditions are distinguished from breast cancer, the earlier life-saving treatment can begin. The initiative stresses the importance of ensuring all women with breast cancer are treated with effective therapies, which are carried through completion. Mikkelsen says failure to act now to address this growing threat will have serious intergenerational consequences.
As a result of the estimated 4.4 million people who died from cancer in 2020, about 1 million children lost their mothers to cancer in that year. One in four of these cancer deaths resulted from breast cancer. The children whose mothers die from cancer experience health and educational disadvantages through all their lives.
WHO acknowledges the cost of drugs to treat breast cancer could be a matter of life or death. It notes the price of certain oral drugs is less than $1, while others range from $9,000 to $10,000. WHO officials say they are working to increase the availability and affordability of breast cancer medication. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotty, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Samson O'Malley, and that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs and Music from our African collection. But first, it's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Samson O'Malley. Hello, Samson.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. Algeria's hopes of winning the CAF African Nations Championship CHAN on home soil were crushed in heartbreaking fashion as they lost 5-4 on penalties to Senegal in the final played on Saturday. The local Teranga Lions edged the host in a very tense final at the Nelson Mandela Stadium in Algiers in front of over 39,000 spectators on a cold winter night. Meanwhile, Algeria set a new tournament record by conceding in 6 games at the tournament in regular time. The final was the first game to go into extra time. On Friday, Madagascar defeated Niger 1-0 to clinch third place of the competition. In athletics, two-time World and Olympic 1,500 meters champion Faith Kipyegon won the Sirikwa Cross Country held at the Labo Village in Eldoret, Kenya. The Kenyan leg of the World Cross Country Gold Tour event brought athletic stars from across 16 countries and saw the peerless Kipyegon take victory in 33 minutes and 50 seconds ahead of second-place Commonwealth steeplechase champion Jacqueline Jepkoech. Kipyegon told reporters after the race that despite having a tough race, she enjoyed the competition.
Say I've enjoyed myself starting the season with the cross country, and I said yesterday this is my first race and starting of the season 2023, and it was really quite good.
In the men's event, national cross country champion Charles Lecour backed his victory from 2 weeks ago with another victorious performance, as he claimed the top honors in the men's race, winning in a time of 30 minutes and 14 seconds. Elsewhere in Lagos, Edwin Kibet of Kenya on Saturday emerged winner of the 2023 Gold Label Access Bank Lagos City Marathon after returning a time of 2 hours 14 minutes 06 seconds to claim the $50,000 prize money. Ethiopian runner Dikeba Tafa came second in 2 hours 14 minutes 54 seconds, while another Kenyan, Bernard San, came third in 2 hours 17 minutes 14 seconds. In the women's category, it was an all-Ethiopian affair as Elmenesh Guta won the race for the second time in 2 hours 40 minutes 42 seconds, to repeat her feat in 2018. In tennis news, South Africa were left with plenty work to do on the second day of their Davis Cup World Group 2 playoff against Luxembourg in Esch-sur-Alzette after losing both singles rubbers on Saturday's opening day of the competition. South Africa will have a chance to claim their way back on Sunday, but they will have to win all three remaining matches to secure victory and remain in the World Cup Group 2 division of the international team competition. And finally, Arsenal fell to just a second Premier League defeat of the season as James Takowiski's header gave Everton the perfect start under new manager Sean Dyche in a 1-0 win at Goodison Park on Saturday. And that's all for this week's edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Samson. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Hopefully, many, many Africans have been able to follow the visit of Pope Francis, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, DRC, and his visit to South Sudan. You do not have to be a Catholic or even a Christian. You can be a non-believer. But it is highly important that Africans follow what is transpired between Pope Francis and his flock in Southern Africa. He is a unique man. His appointment as Pope marked a break from a very long tradition about the origin of popes. Although his ethnicity is Italian, he is a thorough Argentinian, and therefore the first pope to hail from the global south. You could see the way he spoke, his understanding and empathy for the African people. This is because, as somebody from the global south, he is able to feel the pain and frustration of the African people. When he speaks about the impact of colonialism and the exploitation of African wealth, resources, other resources, and even human resources, you could see that he understands what makes the African kicks. The people of the DRC have enthusiastically received him, and they looked forward to his blessing and hope of providing some salvation. The reason is that Pope Francis was able and have been able for some time now to fulfill his dual role of head of state as the Pontiff of Rome and as Catholic Pope. He is trying to make different interpretation to allow for Africans, the largest Catholic group now in the globe, to perform their duties without many encumbrances. He is not the man who believes he knows all. He is quite humble. And he once said, and I quote, "Who am I to throw the first stone in terms of the biblical teaching?" And he moves to South Sudan and joined by his ecumenical brothers, the Archbishop of Canterbury and the head of the Episcopalian Church in Scotland. And their mission, as they said it themselves, is a pilgrimage of peace in the Sudan. That country has been troubled by many, many problems dealing with peacemaking. The Pope himself tried his hand sometime when he symbolically kissed the feet of South Sudanese negotiator in promotion of peace in that country. And in the intervening period, impartial analysts will reach a conclusion that the conclusive note of that period is hopelessness. And now the clerics are trying to see whether divine intervention could help in Sudan. But at this stage, what is clear is that the political class in South Sudan in particular continues to wage a power struggle for high office, for wealth, from them with little regard for the feelings of the suffering people of South Sudan. What may happen in the future, no one knows. But if possible, that this divine intervention of the world clerical chiefs may be able to remove the cloud of hopelessness in the peace process in Sudan and open a new dawn. In looking at their mission and knowing how difficult it will be, I recall what one of my best choice for 19th century novelists in England wrote in many of his novels. Anthony Trollope understands human tragedy, and he chronicled this in two separate parts of his novels, The Church and The State. In The Church, he gives the life of the church and in politics how to find a true and honest leader for the people. But he wrote something, penned one in one of his novels that I think may be relevant today, particularly in South Sudan. And I quote, "If the ears are too delicate to hear the truth, then the mind will be too perverse to profit from it. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent.
Yeah. Come on, attack a two week, give you love, or make me feel it, love me, make me love again. When you want to know, but I'm a heartbreak, it's on a shot, when I go back and repeat again. Wano muti mababu menya kwa menye kakuruma Kuruma kubagwe na ya gala muna geya numya Hakeka full robina na kemo la mata But a bitch we were never, and we can never ever
I'm a slave in love, I'm a slave in love no. Baby I'm a slave in love, no. I'm a slave in love no. Whoa.
else and it bring it to don't you?
Sugar, sugar, sugar.
My life is nothing without you.
Sugar, sugar, sugar. Sugar, sugar, sugar.
My life is nothing without you.
Sugar, sugar, sugar.
That was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here, the English service of the Voice of America in Washington. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, including producer Douglas Impuga, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, a wise man never knows all. Only fools know everything. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.